From the studios of Wavefront Audio Visual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 85 of Little Brother for the 14th of May, 2022. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Clearview AI, a facial recognition company that I've talked about on at least seven prior occasions, has hit yet another bump in the road on their plans for world domination. As a reminder, Clearview populated their database of recognizable faces by scraping social media for faces that have been tagged with names. This ran afoul of European law and Australian law. And now a judge in Chicago has ruled it also runs afoul of Illinois law. The American Civil Liberties Union sued Clearview AI in federal court over the matter, and Clearview AI have settled the case. As part of the settlement, Clearview is agreeing to restrict the use of its massive collection of facial data, stop selling access to private businesses or individuals across the U.S., and to also stop selling access to its database to Illinois state agencies and police departments for a period of 5 years. Their products will, however, continue to be available to federal agencies, such as Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Brian Chesky, the CEO of Airbnb, has come out in favor of having and keeping his workforce remote. He described the office as, quote, an anachronistic form from a pre-digital age, end quote. Chesky has announced that the Airbnb workforce would be going completely remote. He has acknowledged that there may well be a purpose for an office, but that he's unable to see it. And in order for him to change his mind, the office would have to be able to do something that the home of a remote worker cannot do. As much as I love doing the Pwn of the Week, and yes, we have three of them this week, you might have noticed that there have been fewer of them as of late. The greatest bulk of the Pwns have come from ransomware attacks. Well, there's some interesting news. Ransomware attacks are down. It seems that the sanctions against Russia have made it too difficult to do business. Isn't that neat? If they can't collect, then no point in attacking. Here's one that's going to annoy any of us who use mechanical keyboards as I do. It seems that security researcher Georgi Gerganov has developed a software tool called KeyTap 3. Simply by listening to the sound of a mechanical keyboard at close range, it is possible to decode the typist's keystrokes. A mobile phone's microphone should suffice. The good news is that this isn't a real concern yet, because microphones being close enough to pick up your keystrokes would be pretty obvious, and the accuracy is not perfect as of yet. Given time, however, this may change. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Thank you. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week. It's a busy one this week. As I said in the headlines, we've got three of them. First up, Lincoln College. Now, they didn't get pwned this week, per se, but the consequences manifested this week, as the college in Illinois, named for a particular past U.S. president, also from Illinois, is closing its doors after 157 years. The fact that they operated that long, having opened way before the dawn of the digital age or even of the widespread availability of electricity, and were pushed over the edge by a tech issue, just goes to demonstrate how deeply ingrained technology has become into, well, everything, really. At any rate, they were already hurting from the pandemic when, last December, a ransomware attack put many of their IT systems out of commission, getting in the way of admissions activities. According to a statement on the college's website, no student data was compromised. Now, if you ever wonder about whether or not ransomware has serious consequences, here it is. So, patch your systems. Second on our list, we have Rutube. At least, I am assuming that's how it's pronounced. Rutube is a Russian-owned video hosting service, similar in nature to a US-based one that rhymes with it. It is owned by Gazprom Media, so it's actually an arm of the Russian state media. Anyway, individuals operating under the anonymous flag, which, just as a reminder, is more of a brand than an actual gang, took Rutube out of commission. The attackers claim that they have damaged it beyond repair and leaked the access codes. Rutube claims that they have not lost their source code, admitted that this was the most powerful cyber attack they'd ever witnessed, but states that they will be back eventually. Sticking with the Russian state media, let's go to our third pwn, which is every cable and satellite provider in Russia. For a brief period of time, if you looked at the programming guide, every spot on the grid, every channel, every time slot had the same program name listed. The program description, when translated from Russian, reads, quote, "On your hands is the blood of thousands of Ukrainians and their hundreds of murdered children. TV and the authorities are lying. No to war," end quote. Obviously, with the war in Ukraine, this sort of thing is to be expected. I'd like to take a moment today to talk about the third-party doctrine. I made reference to it in episode 82, but I didn't really go into a lot of detail. You can think of this both as a commentary and as an OPSEC tip. So, let's start with an important portion of the U.S. law, specifically the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. It says, quote, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized," end quote. So let's put that into context. In essence, law enforcement, federal agents, whatever, can show up on your doorstep and ask you to let them search your house. But this amendment to the Constitution gives you the right to say no, at least in theory, unless they have a warrant, which, again, in theory, they're not going to get without explaining themselves to a judge. But you can also say yes. Don't do this, seriously. I'm not a lawyer, but I will stand by the advice that you don't say yes when law enforcement asks to search your house. No, sir, you cannot come in without a warrant. Again, all of this is in theory, but let's pretend for the moment that all of this works the way that it's supposed to. For the record, it sometimes does, but it doesn't always. So the third-party doctrine concerns you doing business with service providers. It essentially says that when you give information to a service provider, be it a bank, a phone company, an ISP, social media company, search engine, whatever, that any expectation of privacy goes out the door with it. Why? Well, once you've provided information to a service provider, a warrant, or more likely a subpoena, can be issued to them by a court. But it might not even go there. It's quite possible that law enforcement will just simply ask. The service provider has no skin in the game, and any information you've provided them, law enforcement now has. Now, in the before times, when people's lives were mostly non-digital in nature, there was a practical limit to what service providers could or needed to collect. Your bank might know who your checks were made out to, and they might even keep track of what you deposited and how and when, but pulling out a history was a time-consuming task involving trawling through paper records and maybe even some microforms. The phone company had a computerized record of who you called, and that would appear on your phone bill along with how long you spent on the phone, but that was only for billing purposes because at the time, most people were charged by the call, and the content of your phone call was generally not recorded in any way unless, you know, you'd done it yourself or had been the subject of a wiretap warrant, God forbid. However, starting with email, things changed. Email providers, whether they're an internet provider or an independent service, must, by their nature, record your messages. If they didn't, you wouldn't be able to pull them up on your devices. It's just central to how it works. Now, every text messaging platform uses some variation of this paradigm. Posts to social media? Oh, you bet that's recorded so it can be shown. SMS messages? All right, maybe they're not recorded, but they're certainly held on to until they get delivered. What about other message apps? Better believe it's recorded. In an example of how old laws and doctrine fail to adapt to changes, all of this is available at the stroke of a judge's pen. So, what can we do about this? Well, here's where we get into this week's OPSEC takeaway. Essentially, give away as little information as you can. VPNs, which I've discussed at great length in episode 53, can hide information from your internet service provider, but all they do is move to another location who it is that you need to trust. Your VPN provider is just another service provider, and they too can receive a subpoena just like your ISP. However, Tor is another story. The Onion Router, as it was originally called because of all of the layers of encryption and routing that went on it, sends your data through all kinds of loops and curls, throws it around the internet in ways that obfuscate the source from the destination and the destination from the source, leaving it essentially impossible to determine who is talking to whom. An easy way to set up Tor is to download the Tor browser bundle and use it. For email providers, a winner seems to be ProtonMail. These folks simply do not allow data to stand unencrypted and don't have the keys to decrypt it. Encryption and decryption are done in your web browser, so the data is never anyplace else in a usable form. For text messaging, secure phone calls, secure video calls, secure file transfer, I will once again, as many times before, recommend Signal Private Messenger. Its only major flaw that I can see from an OPSEC perspective, at least within the scope of this particular threat model, is that it uses your telephone number as an account identifier. Time and again, OpenWhisper Systems, the proprietors of Signal, have responded to subpoenas with information that only contains the time and the date that the account was established and the time and the date that it was most recently used. While they do hold information that could reveal more than that, they have it encrypted in such a way that deliberately makes it fully inaccessible to them, or for that matter, anybody else but you. Lastly, I have to say that from a privacy perspective, social media is a clusterfuck in a dumpster fire. I strongly advise just keeping your distance from it and taking care not to share too much information. Now, should the third-party doctrine stand? Honestly, I believe it should fall. Information held about you by third parties should be held in confidence and protected so as to require a warrant issued against you to retrieve it. It's a gaping hole in everybody's personal security and safety. Now, I will say that I framed this initially in the form of a legal matter concerning the third-party doctrine, but I want to add a simple thing here for bonus points, and that is that by following these particular OPSEC tips, you also move to protect your data from non-legal attacks. Using these tools will help keep your information yours. As usual, we'll end this week's show with the fail of the week. I honestly don't know where to put credit for this one, but I have to say that what happened here could happen in a number of projects that have nested dependencies. So much software development today, and sometimes even system administration, depends on taking things that someone else created, bolting their own work onto it, and publishing. The vast power of many recent generation programming languages comes from exactly this. However, one language stands out as a problem, and that is JavaScript. The news this week is that one package used in about 2.2 million different projects, a package called ForEach, had an expired domain. Someone else scooped up the domain and now controls the package and the 2.2 million packages that depend on it, all for the price of a domain registration. Can somebody tell me why ForEach functionality isn't in the core of JavaScript? I mean, it's in Python and Perl and Bash to name a few. Why not JavaScript? This is stupid. Anyway, this is a potential dumpster fire that could have been completely prevented. Okay, so we have a second one as well. I really don't like to think in terms of conspiracies, but this one is so incredibly, terminally stupid that I'm not even clear on how this mistake could have been made accidentally. There is a severity 9.8 vulnerability in Big IP F5 appliances. These appliances are used in commercial data centers as firewalls, load balancers, sometimes even VPN appliances. That 9.8, by the way, is on a scale of 0 to 10. This is bad. It seems as though there's a very easy way to get a command shell from the built-in web server. Why is that a problem? Well, I mean, obviously, first off, you've got some sort of control over the machine, but it seems like the web server runs as root, so that command shell has god-level privileges. Now, the good news is, F5 have issued a patch for it. Do I need to say it? Yes. Yes, I do. Patch your systems! Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Seth Hall, Azriel, Private Eyes, Ed, and Funkaboo for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwnt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. And our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or the topics that are covered in it, or just want to join the conversation, please drop me an email, critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well.